Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to In Our Times with Cheryl Lubin, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, and you are once again with In Our Times here on LA Talk Radio. You can listen to us each and every Tuesday afternoon, early evening, 5 p.m. live, Pacific Standard Time here from our LA Talk Radio studios in Sherman Oaks. And if you don't catch us live, then you can always catch us anytime, sort of in perpetuity at any point after that from our show page at latalkradio.com. Just go to the Channel 1 drop-down menu and look for the title In Our Times. Or you can find us anytime on iTunes or Stitcher. Both of those places we've been enjoying happy homes there, and we are so grateful for our growing audience. We're so excited to be celebrating our third anniversary on the air here at LA Talk Radio. In Our Times, the show that, well, we try to kind of feature the convergence of the arts and politics and the delightful mishmash that they are, or any of those things. So if you want to find us on iTunes, and you do, then go ahead and listen to our show. You can subscribe and review, and we would love your feedback. Also, do not forget to download our free, handy LA Talk Radio app, because it's really spectacular. It's been around for a little while now, I think almost a year, and it's just great because you can then, you know, listen at your leisure and have it really accessible and handy and listen to all our other great shows here on LA Talk Radio. So I have the distinct pleasure of welcoming a very talented trio here. We have executive Lisa Brenner, who is an actress, a producer. She is the founder of a theater company here. Is it what is the name of your theater company again?
It's called Electric Footlights.
Electric Footlights. I was about to say electric, but I didn't. So Electric Footlights.
Yes.
And Lisa, you are you have executive produced a play, mm-hmm. fascinating play. I was told, Cheryl, you have to go see this play, and I was sort of really excited to see it and to be interviewing you. So you've executive produced a play written by, we have the playwright right here, Wendy Graff, and the play is called Please Don't Ask About Beckett, which is such an intriguing title that I'm excited to talk to you about that as well. So welcome, Lisa. Welcome, Wendy.
Hello.
And we also have the fabulous actor, Rob Nagel, whom I recognize from his guest starring turn on Grey's Anatomy, as well as many other things. I've also seen many shows at Antaeus.
Say it how you want to.
Okay.
As long as you're in the theater, it doesn't matter.
And I remember that Nagel rhymes with bagel, so
there
that was
go.
My little ding frame of reference here.
Hello.
So I'm very excited to have you all here, and I want to say that Please Don't Ask About Beckett, it's a world premiere, it's a new play, right? And it's playing at the Sacred Fools Black Box Theater Company through September 19th or 20th?
I think it's September 17th.
Oh, 17th. Okay, so that's a little bit less time. So, yeah, folks, you've got to see this. I've been talking this play up to everyone I know and sort of bugging people, but that's okay. It's okay to bug people in the name of going to the theater, because every play that I've ever, you know, whenever I push people to go, they end up like loving it and feeling immersed in it somehow. So this play, and before we get into it and I ask a lot of you many, many different things about the show itself, I just wanted to say that the LA Times, really, they loved the show. They loved the play. And aside from many of the positive things that they said about it, it says, Wendy Graff's emotionally astute drama peels away layers of pathology with surgical skill, deftly exposing the blow-by-blow devolution of what, in this case, a beleaguered family. It's all about, when you say, I mean, this play is about family dynamics, right? Tell us a little bit, if you would, about the sort of, in broad strokes, initially, about the play.
Well, the play is about family, and it's about family dynamics, and it's seen through the lens of, I would say, upper middle class privilege in Los Angeles in the 70s and the 80s. But at the heart of the story, it's really it's really about a young woman's search for selfhood and how she needs to break away from her family and redefine these relationships in order to become an adult. And it's about she and her relationship with her twin. And, you know, it asks a lot of questions. Maybe it asks some questions about nature and nurture. Maybe it asks some questions about parenting and the choices that you make or the choices that you feel that you need to make and, you know, the mistakes that are made and how one person in the family can possibly affect the rest of the family, like dropping a pebble in a lake and with concentric circles. You know, it goes on and on and on.
I found it, and it's wonderfully description because this is a family that, well, initially, one would want to be a part of, it seems. I mean, these parents, wouldn't you say, Rob, actually, you play the father, right?
Yes, I
and,
do.
And Hunter Garner plays
Correct.
Beckett.
Yep.
Emily Seyfarth, is that?
Rachel.
Yeah. Rachel plays Emily. And Deborah Puette?
Deborah Puette.
Puette, okay, plays your lovely wife.
Yes.
And so we do see the beginnings of two parents who they truly love their children, and they didn't just have children, you know, as an afterthought or as a sort of societal command, you must breathe. It seems like their choice, the choice of these parents to have children was quite a very conscious and deliberate decision, right? And so it seems like there's a lot of really strong good intentions and genuine love. And we see as the layers are peeled away that things are revealed and things change. But was that something that you kind of thought about as you were creating this family? That there's genuine love there.
Oh yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I'm a very instinctual writer, so I don't like sit down and say, I'm going to write about this and this and this and this. And this actually came out of a 48-hour writing challenge in my Pacific Resident Theater writing group where you
oh,
have
wow.
48 hours, you know, start, finish, you can't go back, you just keep moving forward, you can't edit, you can't read it over, and it just sort of pours out of you.
Wow.
So what came out of it were three monologues, the mother, the father, and the girl. And then as I developed the play, you know, I added in Beckett because everybody wanted to see Beckett. Oh, God, now I forget what you were first asking. Did I plan this out? You know, no, because I'm an instinctual writer, and because I am, I sort of let my characters lead me. And through the development process, of which I find is finding the play, it's like, to me, you start with a big piece of marble, and you mm-hmm. chip away and chip away and chip away till you find the play. And through the workshop procedure and through rehearsals and through having, like, amazingly smart and talented actors who bring so much to the roles and inform you of a lot of who these characters are, it all just kind of evolves, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was wonderfully so. Lisa, let me ask you so you're a producer as well as, I mean, you have a long list of television and film credits, mm-hmm. I should say. But so what sort of drew you to this particular project?
Okay, well, I was done producing, like I always am after a play, and we were at the Stage Raw Awards, and I ran into Wendy. I was introduced to her, and it, of course, just came out of me, do you have any plays that you're interested in having produced? And she sent it to me first thing in the morning, and as soon as I read it, I couldn't put it down. And when that happens, like, oh no, here we go, I have to produce this. It just so connected with me as a parent here in Los Angeles. The conversations between the mother and father are exact conversations my husband and I have about our then 9-year-old. Just, we love her so much, but can we love her too much?
Oh, yeah.
And we want to do everything for her, but she needs to make mistakes. And it just is fascinating to me how you can raise two children, and so symbolic with the twins,
yeah,
the same exact age, giving them the same family dynamic, the same love, although maybe that's questionable in this, and they turn out completely different.
Right. And you're right. And the heart of this story, so much of it really is essentially identity and how much will Emily, right, how much will she sort of remain, I don't want to say tethered, but remain, how much will she have to kind of release herself a bit from the grip of her twin brother Beckett's, you know, magnetic allure or whatever one may call it. Rob, as the father Hollywood mogul.
Yes, yes, that's me.
You look, you know, way too young to have actually been of that era and so forth. But however, you sort of hauntingly reminded me of many of the parents I knew back in the, having been raised here in LA in the late, you know, mid to late 70s through the 80s. Mm-hmm. And there was a powerful connection I felt among all of the characters. Tell us how you approached the character of the father a little bit. Tell us a little bit about what that was like.
Well, I've lived in Los Angeles for the last 19 years, and so I think I've seen some of the parenting skills around town, the skills and the lack of skills in some
right,
cases.
Right, right.
So you see a lot of challenges in a big industry town like this. So I think to some degree, I was sort of prepared by just living here uh-huh. to understand what any major city has challenges with when you have great wealth around you and substantial possibility for future in your children, and how do you nurture that out of them? And some parents do it very, very well, and some parents stumble along the way. So I think living in Los Angeles had a great deal to do with that.
Right, right.
Also, just imagined what it would have been like to been Robert Evans at the time, or you know, running
oh, yeah.
running a studio and all of the craziness that happened through the 70s before, you know, we all went a little crazy in the 80s. And
right,
it felt like a town I knew only from living around it and also watching a lot of television, a lot of film. At the heart of it, it's a family that looks like it's all together and doing really, really well.
Yeah.
On the outside, they've got every bit of possibility about them, and both the twins, both the kids do. And then on the inside, you realize that you throw a few little curveballs into there. You put some addiction into a family or put expectations on the
right,
children. And
right.
the next thing you know, things are starting to crumble around you, and the parents have no idea how it happened or how they could have avoided it.
Yeah, yeah. I went home and I was sort of, my head was so, after I saw this show, my head was sort of filled with like little thoughts. I kind of wrote down some random things, because there are, while it's quite specific to a socioeconomic time and place, the play feels very universal to me, and that you know, this could be all of us here in this room. It seems to me, as many of us here as parents, although many of us as certainly as adults ourselves who were parented, right, have this relationship with, I don't know, the expectations we felt we could or could not meet that were placed on us, I suppose, as children. Tell us about the relationship between you and your onstage wife. You seem to focus or seem to be like very, very focused on raising the children in a particular way, right? In a very conscious and particular way. And you were alluding to that a few minutes ago. Anyone want to speak to that aspect of it here? That there's there's definite love there. We sense that, you know, that there's love, but that also that the parents are wanting to create a sort of world for their kids that is, you know, in which they're buffered. Does that enter into this at all as you
see it? Well, I think part of the inspiration for the play was I was a young mother in the 80s, you know, in the latter half of the 80s. My kids mostly grew up in the 90s. But I think that it was the first generation of parents who parenting became, for a lot of mothers, parenting became, that was their job.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were used to being successful. You know, it was sort of what the yuppies, it was the, when the yuppies came of age.
Right.
You know, and they'd all been very successful in business and out there in the world. And then they brought that same need to be successful with their children. So what ended up happening was a lot of over-identification with the children.
Yeah.
And then, you know, desperation for these kids to, you know, to succeed and to achieve. And I'm not saying that I was completely, you know, innocent all that.
I think I've been that way a little bit as a mother. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it, to the point of where I think it was the first generation of where we said, we're applying to, so, you know.
Yeah, I remember that from the play, actually. And there's a wonderful bit with the, oh my God, is it a shirt or a... wonderful direction.
Sweater.
Kit Scholl, is that the name of your...
Kit.
Wonderful direction, and it's just something about where Deborah, she repacks something
the
that Emily...
A green sweater.
Yeah. Yep.
Straight
okay.
out of my life.
Yeah. So, I mean, wonderful, that was a wonderful bit that I felt was quite symbolic. There's another scene I want to talk about where you're smoking with your daughter, which I don't mean to sound disapproving of that at all. I just, it was kind of fascinating to me. But anyway, getting back to what you were saying about this very sense of strong expectations or over-identification is what you were saying.
And
yeah.
What a lot of it led to was, and I've seen it now, and this was part of the inspiration for the play, my kids are adults now, and they grew up in a very, you know, privileged atmosphere at privileged private schools, et cetera, with a lot of kids who, you know, parents were studio heads and you know, big-time agents and, you know, powerful people in the entertainment business, powerful people in the, you know, in finance and law, and high-profile parents. And there were some that the parents just couldn't help, but, you know, they wanted them to go to a certain school, so they maybe gave some extra money.
Right.
And things like that. Well, unfortunately, what happened was a lot of those kids ended up feeling that they could never do it on their own. Mm-hmm. And that's that's kind of what I was going for with Beckett. You know, they never had a sense of self. Their parents wanted to save them. They didn't want them to suffer. You know, we don't want our kids to suffer disappointment. It hurts when your kid comes home and says they lost the election or they weren't invited to the party or, you know, this or that. But you've got to, they have to learn how to accept disappointment and put themselves back up on the horse. Otherwise, they're never going to be able to do it as adults. And you can't rob them of that. You have to teach them how to fail and to be resilient.
That resilience, I really, it seems that I would imagine that maybe the parents are, I actually heard a couple people behind me talking after the show was over about, you know, oh, you know, those parents, you know, grumble. But it seems to me that the father and mother here of the twins, Beckett and Emily, that they are, that there's a lot of personal, I don't know, memories or angst that they're bringing to the experience of being parents that informs the way they are with their kids and the mistakes they're making.
I think we all do.
Yeah.
I think every parent brings, you visit all the positives and the negatives on the child. In the effort to, if you came from a house filled with abuse or filled with neglect or filled with discomfort even, you decide you're not going to give that to your own child. You're going to keep your child from ever having to feel that. And the result, of course, is that you have a child for the rest of their lives. They never become an adult. They never understand disappointment. They never understand how to take care of themselves. They're bailed out constantly, and sometimes they cause harm to others, and often they do. That's what resonates for me the most. This is a family drama that every family has part of in them, and I've been astonished in the last 3 weeks of the or 2 weeks now of performances that how many people, friends and people I don't know, who have come up to me afterwards with you can see it in their eyes how much their family is the family they're watching. All in an effort to take care of our kids.
And you're right. I'm thinking that as parents, we we want so much to give our children only the best of what we may have experienced of from our own parents, only the best that we feel and see and experience of the world. And of course, we're not going to impose anything negative. And that to the extent that doesn't happen, or they don't turn out the way that we had hoped, there's such a nice idyllic image in our minds as we begin. I mean, this is your child. This is your opportunity to kind of, imprint on a human being, and you feel the true sincerity of these people so much. It's not that there's nothing but good, pure intentions here for the most part, it seems to me, in this play. And the fact that they go awry, is it fair to say, that sense of connection that the audience feels, I think, with the show and with the characters. Yeah.
And also, what I love about the play is no one's to blame.
Yes,
and
yeah.
So much of it is the nature of the child. I mean, as a parent, you want to believe that you're going to be the be-all and end-all for this child, and if you just do so-and-so, it'll be great. And then the child comes in with their completely own personality and emotions.
How dare they? Yeah. Just kidding. Well, that's what Emily and Beckett are. These
right.
two. Emily is she really idolizes her twin brother? Mm-hmm. They are. He plays the guitar. They're singing for their parents. They're proud, beaming parents who are documenting everything like 80s style from those like video recorders. And they're singing, just like a woman in their like cute little chirpy kid voices. And you're just thinking that, she really idolizes him. But time passes and they sort of reveal themselves, and they're very different people. And where did that come from? It's a fascinating question, right? Mm-hmm.
Nature and nurture.
Both. Or both. It's really with the twins. I mean, the fact that they've kind of created this wonderful world where they're playful with each other. I was really struck by the mother. I keep saying mother and father, but the names again.
Grace and Rob.
Grace and Rob. Oh, that one must have been...
It's easy for me
yeah,
to
easy
remember.
For you. There's a moment, and it's not... I mean, it happens very logically in the context of the play, but where Grace says, maybe more than once, what did I do wrong? Mm-hmm. And I sort of caught my breath when I heard that, because that the way she said it and the feelings... This is a woman who really wants it to be something she can fix, something she can control. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want to control her kids, it seems to me. Otherwise, it would just be, Lady Macbeth or Medea, and that that would be the end of it. And those are fascinating plays. But this is a very complicated woman and a very complicated father, mm-hmm. too. How are you and Grace different? How are Rob and Grace different as parents? They're alike in their love for their kids, obviously.
They're certainly alike in their love for their kids and their hope to not let their kids ever suffer any minute of stress. I think Grace is probably a bit more of a stronger helicopter parent than Rob is. Probably a little more emotionally involved in the sense of when she sees them in distress, it upsets her. Rob perhaps has a bit more of a pragmatic attitude about it and a realistic attitude about it in the sense of, you need a dose of reality. Sometimes you don't want to bail out the child. Sometimes they need to learn from their mistakes. And she doesn't want to see anything like that happen. So between the two of them, they have a partnership that is at odds with one another. The goals are the same, but how to get to them are quite, quite different. But at the end of it, they both love, of course, with great devotion, both of their kids.
Beckett and Emily, very, very different, and Emily sort of becomes the child on whom the parents rely, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone want to talk about how we see, because so much of the story is told through Emily's, or really told from Emily's perspective, what is it? How would we describe the difference in the relationship between Emily and her parents and Beckett and her parents? Anybody? How about Lisa? What do you think?
Oh gosh. Well, I see this happening too much where the parents and the child become friends, and the parents give too much of their problems on the child, and I think they do that a lot with Emily. They treat her like an equal instead of a child, and it puts a big burden on her to be a grown-up really fast, whereas Beckett could do no wrong and is treated like a child and with love and care and concern. So that's one of the big differences.
It's a fascinating moment. I was thinking about so much of what you just said, and the idea that the scene where, well, I mean, Emily is constantly being asked by the parents, right? You know,
how's he doing?
Right, how's he doing? And there's a, I found the scene between you and Emily, father and daughter, kind of fascinating, where you're smoking pot, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
he comes to her because he needs something stronger than a gin and tonic.
Yeah, yeah, it's just gin and tonic won't do it. And I don't mean to sound like moralistic. I mean, I had no judgment whatsoever about that fact. I found myself kind of thinking this is one of the more unguarded emotional moments for your character, I thought.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
yes.
Tell us about that and how that, what did it feel like to think about that scene and to play in that scene a little bit?
Well, to piggyback on what Lisa just said, sometimes we may misstep as adults, as parents, whether we're mothers, fathers, aunts, uncles, or just in a position of elderliness, I guess, and to become the friend of the child or the confidant of the child sort of skews the function of the family. It was once described to me that dysfunctional family is really just when roles aren't being played the way they're supposed to be played.
Oh.
So when the parent is all of a sudden needing the care from the child as opposed to being the caregiver to the child,
right,
that's where dysfunction sets in. Now, I don't even know if there's such a thing as a functional family. I think
that's kind of an interesting question.
That's an oxymoron, isn't it? I mean,
not
can it really be? But I think the scene in which Rob and his daughter Emily smoke pot together, share a joint, and talk a little bit about Beckett, and Rob shares a bit about his own family history and his own older brother, I think is one of my favorite scenes in the play. Rachel and I both just love acting it together, because it's a strange thing to see a father and a daughter sharing on that level, and the daughter saying, "You can't talk to me about this,"
yeah,
and the father saying,
yeah,
"Okay, I won't, but I really need to." It's a beautifully, beautifully wrought scene,
yeah,
and it really points up both the love and that dysfunction in the family. It's inherent there. He's sneaking outside to get a hit of some pot from his daughter. While mom's inside, probably, you know, planning the next trip to wherever.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
It's a beautiful and very tender scene, and also you can, I think, on the outside watch it and think, oh, this family might be in trouble.
And she does. Emily does. It both Emily and Beckett kind of. When you say Wendy, I mean they're both. Or it struck me that they're both really good at sort of asking of the, you know, see who I am, see what I need. But they do it in very different ways, right? I mean, Emily is very strong and forthright about, you know, Dad, you can't talk to me that way. This is, I'm your daughter. You're supposed to take care of me. And this is, and it feels like she's almost a voice in the wilderness, it seems. Like everybody else in the family is focused on something else. Any thoughts about that? Yeah.
Well, you know, I kind of hesitate to, like, speak too much about this kind of thing. One of the things about working with really great actors is that they find the characters, and they find some of these things that you instinctually were starting to go towards in your writing, but they find it. And then they can elucidate
yeah.
it. It's kind of like, I find it such an interesting story about casting Deborah Puett.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had imagined the Grace in a completely different way. And I brought in all the actresses that had worked on the workshops and everything. And we saw a lot of women with a very specific description in the breakdown. And at the end of it, you know, everybody was sort of going, I'm not feeling it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I, you know, we said, what should we do? I said, well, maybe we should see more people. So then I said, maybe we should see people who are completely different, you know? And I mean, I've known Deborah Puett's work. I mean, she's just like, I mean, she's incredible. She never has a false note. I said she could put on the costume after the first week and do it, and it would have been great. You know, so I called Lucy Pollock, and I said, can you get me her info, or can you clear it, see if she's available? And then it was just like, yeah, this is the character. This has been what was wrong. And then I, you know, then we had to, like, kind of shave off some of the vestiges of the old character. And she really found that character that had so much honesty and so much truth and so much power. Because I think I was looking at it kind of from the outside in, not really realizing that that character has so much power. And she really found it and defined it, and it evolved. So it's hard for me to come in and say, oh, well, this is what I was looking for, and this is
right,
what I was
right.
planning.
That makes sense. And you see it when you encounter it, and then they bring it to life even more.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, tell us, what about Rob, who's here, and Hunter, who's not, and Rachel, who, you know, they sort of made, you know, more concrete the characters who you would first encountered on the page, right?
Well, Rob was in my last play that I produced.
Yes, just last fall, The Killer Dies by Megan Brown.
Yes, and as soon as I read this, I knew Rob had to play Rob. And no matter what actor we brought in, I was comparing him to Rob Nagel. But Rob was working on another show at the time, and it was every time an actor left the room, my heart would break. I wish Rob, and then the night before callbacks, he had a change of schedule, and we brought him in, and that was it. I mean, he is Rob. I mean, he's just so talented, and so, I mean, the character is so powerful in the industry, and such a powerful dad, but Rob Nagel himself is so lovable that you just adore this man, no matter what he does or says.
Humanity. He gives him so much humanity.
Yes.
I'm blushing. Thank you.
No, really. Every father in the audience is out there going, "Oh God, that was me."
Yes. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean that. I mean, that's what you were saying. I can't even tell. Like last night, 20 people came up to me and went, "Oh my God, my brother is back. Oh my God, my sister. Oh my God, my parents were."
It everybody's got someone in their family
it's
like
crazy.
This.
Crazy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it hits us all in the same kind of hard, surprising way.
Yeah, yeah. It's very painful, and yet it's rather a relief to see it. You feel sort of vindicated. Like this is, we see this, and it's a beautifully created dynamic among the four of you, I have to say.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Let's talk about the way it's staged, because I really liked the sort of, I don't want to say minimalist aspect of it, but the fact that you're the movements around the stage, when you're talking to one another on the phone or to indicate distance, there are certain things that are done that to me really made a lot of sense. It kind of fit into place quite neatly, I thought.
I wish Kif was here to talk about it.
Oh.
This is all him.
Okay.
He's amazing. Every time I watch the production, I just see the cleverness and just how intricate the costume changes are and the staging and the lighting and how he highlights certain moments that you really don't miss a beat no matter where you're sitting. And if you do miss a beat, it's intentional. It's kind of amazing that as an audience, it's almost you don't get to see everything, because some families do hide things. And especially the mother, Grace. Because at first, as Wendy was saying, we kind of saw her just as pure, loving, bohemian, into her vitamins. But there is this aspect of Grace that is about the show and being a West Side mother that wants things to look a certain way.
Yeah.
Much to the detriment of her children at times. So, yeah, there is the complexity that Kif was able to really bring to the stage by staging it in the round that way. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, and the fact that it's in the round, the emotions just kind of wash over you. I mean, you're very present with this family. I almost felt a bit of a voyeur, mm-hmm. you know. I was sort of, I'm sorry that I'm invading your living room or your living space, but I kind of felt like we were just sort of right there. Like, yes. Wouldn't it be great if, like, for any family that, you know, there could be sort of a, you know, an objective observer and all these sort of unforeseen moments, and then, but then that might be too invasive, I guess. But, you know,
oh, God.
Yeah, that might be a little too much.
I'm not signing up for that.
But it would probably be a little too much. But it's sort of like, oh, yes, we see sort of, we can see it there, what's happening, but the family members don't. They're just living their lives. So it felt very natural in the context of the round.
Everyone is a fly on the wall watching this family dynamic, yes. Watching everything happen.
And you know, we can feel a little bit smug because I didn't make that mistake as a mother, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm just kidding.
Right.
I mean, you know, I'm
exactly
so
right.
much better than that. Or,
that's exactly right. That's a line in the play.
Yeah. I had so many fascinating thoughts about the timeline and the time and place and the generational. I was thinking about the 1970s, the kinds of parenting that went on in the 1980s, and I feel like you really kind of very subtly kind of layered in the ways in which people who may have had children in the late 70s to the early 80s around that time would have had their children in a very different way from what they themselves experienced, and it was, you know, maybe they had been neglected in some way, they felt, and I just, it was a very powerful evocation of a world that I knew. What did you think about the ways that people parented, let's say, the way that maybe Rob and Grace were parented, or the way in which they're kind of reacting to?
I don't know if I should say this, but I just sort of drew on my own experiences of parenting and the people around me, and I didn't really think, you know, 70s, 80s.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I mean, the effect was there, but for sure, but yeah.
So I can't really. I remember saying to my daughter when she was applying to college, you know, and I said, I wish my mother would have been interested in reading my college application.
Oh,
she gave me $10 and told me I could only apply to University of California, and I'm going around with you all over the country to look at schools. And I let me read this over.
Uh-huh.
You know, I wish my mother cared enough to read over uh-huh. my college application. You know, I think that's sort of it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I think maybe I'm turning red because I'm thinking, oh my God. I mean, there isn't any way. I mean, I suppose the richness of this play and the universality of it is that, you know, I can look at it and think about it and watch it and think, well, I can draw upon things that I experienced myself, you know, but other people who grew up in different times and places can, you know, recognize the same thing. So someone who grew up in the 50s in Ohio, or, you know, grew up here in the 90s or whatever, they would have different feelings about it. But we all sort of, there are so many ways in which we might identify with Grace, or we might identify with Emily, mm-hmm. who just wants to be seen. And why can't her father, who does love her, why can't he get beyond his own need to, you know, use her as a confidant or something?
Mm-hmm.
There's so much that was very rich. I went home and I kind of spoke about this play with my daughter. She was going to come with me initially to see it, and she's 16 now, and she's come with me to many times to Antillas to uh-huh. see a lot of plays, and she just wasn't able to make it, but she was very interested she's very interested in being a psychologist one day. I don't know whether she actually will when the time comes, but she said, you know, wow, it just seems to me like there's like psychologists should come see this show. There's something there about what makes a family work or not work, but just in the most real, authentic way in which it shows up on stage. Mm-hmm. So
I think anyone with a family would connect to it. Anyone. I mean,
yeah.
I feel so connected with the Emily Beckett relationship, just because my brother and I are so close. We're 4 years different, but just the love between us.
Right.
Yeah, didn't you
there.
Just, you were so taken at the beginning by the scene where she sings to her brother.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and he says, just keep singing him. And just,
yeah.
I mean, only the close love between two people can represent that. It's, I just love this play so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful play, and I have to. There was something about Beckett, I think, in the hands of a less masterful playwright, a less capable actor, we might have Beckett could become. I don't know. It could be very frustrating. It is frustrating to see him not, you know, not do as well as one would have hoped. But you find yourself rooting for all these people, right? You find yourself really rooting for Beckett to make it and to do well. Mm-hmm. So that's quite a fascinating idea. There were a lot of feelings that came up for me in seeing this play about unspoken and spoken expectations within a family, mm-hmm. between parents and children. Anyone want to toss that, you know?
Oh, you should have my kids in.
We have a call in. We have a call in from your kids. They can
yes,
speak
are
to
you
that.
Calling in?
Hey, Mom, I had an idea about that one.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, because I took some of the stuff, you know, that I've always been accused of, and I used that too. And, you know.
Was that healing for you? Was that sort of. That must be like you take sort of memories you have and write it out, and then you see, you know.
Yeah, but then I just have to make sure that I don't piss anybody off. Because
that's the trick.
The
yeah.
first reading, everybody came in my family, and they were all like, you need to change the names. And I'm not like that. The other night at dinner, my daughter says, yeah, to her brother, yeah, you ought to go see the play. I'm not in this one. And I'm so glad. And I thought, she thinks she's not.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, this idea of expectations that are, but yeah, both spoken and unspoken seem to be a theme.
You know, they just know... They just know. They can see it on your face. They know your daughters know your Achilles heel. They know your hot buttons. They just know, you know. And a lot of times when you're saying things like, I don't know, the only thing that I can think that I can compare it to is kind of like sometimes mothers get into things with daughters about their weight. Mm-hmm. And then they say, then something happens, and there's an eating disorder, there's something, and you know, they go to the therapist, and they say, I don't say anything about her weight, and they say, I can see it on your face. I can see it on your face where you look at my plate at dinner, and all that kind of thing. You know, so that's, I think parents and children, you know, and children and their parents, I mean, even with my mother now, she's 92 years old, and we still have that, you know, those unspoken kind of things that I know what's going on, and I know what she's saying. I mean, I'm sure you guys all do,
too. Oh, gosh. I mean, it's not good enough that what you say, now you have to worry about how subconsciously
right.
you're appearing to your children at every moment. Oh, my gosh, it's crazy-making.
Expectations are a very, very dangerous exactly. thing in this family, in this play, and in all of our families, as is... For my mind, the illusion that we have control over any of this.
Right. It's quite an illusion,
you think that you can control what's going to happen next? Really? Good luck with that. It's not. It's not possible. I think the family in this play grapples with it. I know my family grapples with it. I know I personally grapple with it. How do I maintain some kind of control in all the insanity around?
Yeah.
Kind of have to let go of all of that and say, no, I've got nothing to do with that. I can't. Not my stuff, you know?
And I wonder why that's so hard generally. I mean, maybe not to turn this into a group therapy session, yeah. but why is that so hard generally as someone in whether we're talking about a romantic relationship or more specifically here, a parent-child relationship, why is that letting go so difficult. I mean, particularly vexing and difficult.
From my mind, it's a really existential crisis, because we really need to find meaning for ourselves. We need to feel that we matter. You look up at the sky, you can't in Los Angeles because there are too many lights on the ground, but you look up in the sky and see the stars, and you realize that you're not the first one who felt love, happiness, grief, pain, despair. In the history of the world, really, your problems are that big? They don't amount to that much if you look at all the people and all the stars up there and how many people have looked and wished upon one.
Right.
So we feel like we have to matter in some way. And if we can't matter for our children and we can't have an effect on our children, then what's it all for?
Right.
You know, and they'd all been very successful in business and out there in the world, and then they brought that same need to be successful with their children. So what ended up happening was a lot of over-identification with the children,
yeah.
And then, you know, desperation for these kids to, you know, to succeed and to achieve. And I'm not saying that I was completely, you know, innocent all that.
Yeah, myself. I mean, I think I've been that way a little bit as a mother. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it, to the point of where I think it was the first generation of where we said, we're applying to, so, you know.
Yeah, I remember that from the play, actually. And there's a wonderful bit with the, oh my God, is it a shirt or a wonderful direction?
Sweater.
Kit Scholl, is that the name of your?
Kit.
Wonderful direction, and it's just something about where Deborah, she repacks something
the
that Emily
a green
does
sweater.
Not, yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Straight out of my life.
Yeah. So, I mean, wonderful, that was a wonderful bit that I felt was quite symbolic. There's another scene I want to talk about where you're smoking with your daughter, which I don't mean to sound disapproving of that at all. I just, it was kind of fascinating to me. But anyway, getting back to what you were saying about this very sense of strong expectations or over-identification is what you were saying.
And
yeah.
What a lot of it led to was, and I've seen it now, and this was part of the inspiration for the play, my kids are adults now, and they grew up in a very, you know, privileged atmosphere at privileged private schools, et cetera, with a lot of kids who, you know, parents were studio heads and you know, big-time agents and, you know, powerful people in the entertainment business, powerful people in the, you know, in finance and law, and high-profile parents. And there were some that the parents just couldn't help but, you know, they wanted them to go to a certain school, so they maybe gave some extra money.
Right.
And things like that. Well, unfortunately, what happened was a lot of those kids ended up feeling that they could never do it on their own. And that's kind of what I was going for with Beckett. You know, they never had a sense of self. Their parents wanted to save them. They didn't want them to suffer. You know, we don't want our kids to suffer disappointment. It hurts when your kid comes home and says they lost the election or they weren't invited to the party or, you know, this or that. But you've got to, they have to learn how to accept disappointment and put themselves back up on the horse. Otherwise, they're never going to be able to do it as adults. And you can't rob them of that. You have to teach them how to fail and to be resilient.
That resilience, I really, it seems that I would imagine that maybe the parents are, I actually heard a couple people behind me talking after the show was over about, you know, oh, you know, those parents, you know, grumble. But it seems to me that the father and mother here of the twins, Beckett and Emily, that there's a lot of personal, I don't know, memories or angst that they're bringing to the experience of being parents that informs the way they are with their kids and the mistakes they're making.
I think we all do.
Yeah.
I think every parent brings, you visit all the positives and the negatives on the child.
Yes.
If you came from a house filled with abuse or filled with neglect or filled with discomfort even,
right.
You decide you're not going to give that to your own child. You're going to keep your child from ever having to feel that. And the result, of course, is that you have a child for the rest of their lives. They never become an adult. They never understand disappointment. They never understand how to take care of themselves. They're bailed out constantly. constantly, and sometimes they cause harm to others, and often they do. That's what resonates for me the most. This is a family drama that every family has part of in them, and I've been astonished in the last 3 weeks of the or 2 weeks now of performances that how many people, friends and people I don't know, who have come up to me afterwards with you can see it in their eyes how much their family is the family they're watching. All in an effort to take care of our kids.
And you're right. I'm thinking that as parents, we want so much to, right, give our children only the best of what we may have experienced of from our own parents, only the best that we feel and see and experience of the world. And of course, we're not going to, you know, impose anything negative. And that to the extent that doesn't happen, or they don't turn out the way that we had hoped, there's such a nice idyllic image in our minds as we begin. I mean, this is your child. This is your opportunity to kind of, you know, imprint on a human being, and you feel the true sincerity of these people so much. There's nothing but good, pure intentions here for the most part, it seems to me, in this play. And the fact that they go awry, is it fair to say, that sense of connection that the audience feels, I think, with the show and with the characters. Yeah.
And also, what I love about the play is no one's to blame.
Yes,
and
yeah.
So much of it is the nature of the child. I mean, as a parent, you want to believe that you're going to be the be-all and end-all for this child, and if you just do so-and-so, it'll be great. And then the child comes in with their completely own personality and emotions.
How dare they? Yeah. Just kidding. Well, that's what Emily and Beckett are. These
right.
two. Emily is she really idolizes her twin brother. Mm-hmm. They are. He plays the guitar. They're singing for their parents. They're proud, beaming parents who are documenting everything like 80s style from those like video recorders. And they're singing, you know, just like a woman in their like cute little chirpy kid voices. And you're just thinking that, she really idolizes him. But time passes and they sort of reveal themselves, and they're very different people. And mm-hmm. where did that come from? It's a fascinating question, right? Mm-hmm.
Nature and nurture. Both.
Or both. And it's really with the twins. I mean, the fact that they've kind of created this wonderful world where they're playful with each other. I was really struck by the mother. I keep saying mother and father, but the names again.
Grace and Rob.
Grace and Rob. Oh, that one must have been
easy for me.
Yeah,
to
easy
remember.
For you. There's a moment, and it's not. I mean, it happens very logically in the context of the play, but where Grace says maybe more than once, "What did I do wrong?" Mm-hmm. And I sort of caught my breath when I heard that, because that the way she said it and the feelings. This is a woman who really wants it to be something she can fix, something she can control. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want to control her kids, it seems to me. Otherwise, it would just be, you know, Lady Macbeth or Medea, and that, you know, that would be the end of it. And those are fascinating plays. But this is a very complicated woman and a very complicated father, mm-hmm. too. How are you and Grace different? How are Rob and Grace different as parents? They're alike in their love for their kids, obviously.
They're certainly alike in their love for their kids and their hope to not let their kids ever suffer any minute of stress. I think Grace is probably a bit more of a perhaps a stronger helicopter parent than Rob is. Probably a little more emotionally involved, in the sense of when she sees them in distress, it upsets her. Rob perhaps has a bit more of a pragmatic attitude about it and a realistic attitude about it, in the sense of, you know, you need a dose of reality. Sometimes you don't want to bail out the child. Sometimes they need to learn from their mistakes, and she doesn't want to see anything like that happen. So between the two of them, they have a partnership that is at odds with one another. The goals are the same, but how to get to them are quite different. But at the end of it, they both love, of course, with great devotion, both of their kids.
This is, I mean, Beckett and Emily, very, very different. And Emily sort of becomes the child on whom the parents rely, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone want to talk about how we see, because so much of the story is told through Emily's, or really told through, from Emily's perspective, what is it, how would we describe the difference in the relationship between Emily and her parents and Beckett and her parents? Anybody have it? Lisa, what do you think?
Oh, gosh. Well, I see this happening too much where the parents and the child become friends, and the parents give too much of their problems on the child, and I think they do that a lot with Emily. They treat her like an equal instead of a child, and it puts a big burden on her to be a grown-up really fast, whereas Beckett could do no wrong and is treated like a child and with love and care and concern. So that's one of the big differences.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, it's a fascinating moment. I was thinking about so much of what you just said, and the idea that the scene where, well, I mean, Emily is constantly being asked by the parents, right? You know,
how's he doing?
Right, how's he doing? And there's a, I found the scene between you and Emily, father and daughter, kind of fascinating, where you're smoking pot, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
he comes to her because he needs something stronger than a gin and tonic.
Yeah, it's just gin and tonic won't do it. And I don't mean to sound like moralistic. I mean, I had no judgment whatsoever about that fact. I found myself kind of thinking this is one of the more unguarded emotional moments for your character, I thought.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
yes.
Tell us about that and how that, what did it feel like to think about that scene and to play in that scene a little bit?
Well, to piggyback on what Lisa just said, sometimes we may misstep as adults, as parents, whether we're mothers, fathers, aunts, uncles, or just in a position of elderliness, I guess, and to become the friend of the child or the confidant of the child sort of skews the function of the family. It was once described to me that dysfunctional family is really just when roles aren't being played the way they're supposed to be played.
Oh.
So when the parent is all of a sudden needing the care from the child as opposed to being the caregiver to the child,
right,
that's where dysfunction sets in. Now, I don't even know if there's such a thing as a functional family. I think
yeah.
that might
that's
be
kind of an interesting question.
That's an
yeah.
oxymoron, isn't it? I mean,
not
can it really
at my
be?
House.
But I think the scene in which Rob and his daughter Emily smoke pot together, share a joint, and talk a little bit about Beckett, and Rob shares a bit about his own family history and his own older brother, I think is one of my favorite scenes in the play. Rachel and I both just love acting it together because it's a strange thing to see a father and a daughter sharing on that level, and the daughter saying, "You can't talk to me about this,"
yeah,
and the father saying,
yeah,
"Okay, I won't, but I really need to." It's a beautifully, beautifully wrought scene,
yeah.
And it really points up both the love and that dysfunction in the family. It's inherent there. He's sneaking
yeah.
outside to get a hit of some pot from his daughter. While mom's inside, probably planning the next trip to wherever.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
It's a beautiful and very tender scene, and also you can, I think, on the outside watch it and think, oh, this family might be in trouble.
And she does. Emily does. It both Emily and Beckett kind of. Wouldn't you say, Wendy? I mean, they're both. Or it struck me that they're both really good at sort of asking of the, see who I am, see what I need. But they do it in very different ways, right? I mean, Emily is very strong and forthright about, Dad, you can't talk to me that way. This is, I'm your daughter. You're supposed to take care of me. And this is, and it feels like she's almost a voice in the wilderness, it seems. Like everybody else in the family is focused on something else. Yeah. Any thoughts about that? Yeah.
Well, I kind of hesitate to speak too much about this kind of thing. One of the things about working with really great actors is that they find the characters and they find some of these things that you instinctually were starting to go towards in your writing, but they find it. And then they can elucidate
yeah.
it. It's kind of like there was such, I find it such an interesting story about casting Deborah Puette mm-hmm. because I had imagined the Grace in a completely different way, and mm. I brought in all the actresses that we had worked on the workshops and everything, and we saw a lot of women with a very specific description in the breakdown, and at the end of it, you know, everybody was sort of going, I'm not feeling it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I, you know, we said, what should we do? I said, well, maybe we should see more people. So then I said, maybe we should see people who are completely different, you know? And I mean, I've known Deborah Puette's work. I mean, she's just like, I mean, she's incredible. She never has a false note. I said she could put on the costume after the first week and do it, and uh-huh. it would have been great. You know, so I called Lucy Pollock uh-huh. and I said, "Can you get me her info, or can you clear it, see if she's available?" And then it was just like, "Yeah, this is the character. This has been what was wrong." And then we had to like kind of shave off some of the vestiges of the old character, and she really found that character that had so much honesty and so much truth and so much power, because I think I was looking at it kind of from the outside in, not really realizing that that character has so much power, and she really found it and defined it, and it evolved. So it's hard for me to come in and say, oh, well, this is what I was looking for, and this is
right,
what I was
right.
planning.
Right, right. That makes sense. And you see it when you encounter it, and then they bring it to life even more.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, tell us, what about Rob, who's here, and Hunter, who's not, and Rachel, who, you know, they sort of made, you know, more concrete the characters who you would first encountered on the page, right?
Well, Rob was in my last play that I produced.
Yes, just last fall, The Killer yes. Dies by Megan Brown.
Yes, and as soon as I read this, I knew Rob had to play Rob. And no matter what actor we brought in, I was comparing him to Rob Nagel. But Rob was working on another show at the time, and it was every time an actor left the room, my heart would break. I wish Rob, and then the night before callbacks, he had a change of schedule, and we brought him in, and that was it. I mean, he is Rob. I mean, he's just so talented, and so, I mean, the character is so powerful in the industry, and such a powerful dad, but Rob Nagel himself is so lovable that you just adore this man, no matter what he does or says.
Uh-huh. His humanity. He gives him so much humanity.
Yes.
I'm blushing. Thank you.
No, really. Every father in the audience is out there going, oh, God, that was me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, you know? Yeah.
I mean, that's what you were saying. I can't even tell. Like, last night, 20 people came up to me and went, oh, my God, yeah. my brother is back. Oh, my yeah. God, my sister. Oh, my God, my parents were just, yeah.
Yeah, everybody's got someone in their family
it's
like
crazy.
This.
Crazy.
Yes. Yeah.
And it hits us all in the same kind of hard, surprising way.
Yeah, yeah. It's very, it's painful, and yet it's rather a relief to see it. You feel sort of vindicated, like
yeah,
the, yeah like this is we see this, and it's a beautifully created dynamic among the four of you, I have to say.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Let's talk about the way it's staged, because I really liked the sort of, I don't want to say minimalist aspect of it, but
it
the
is.
Fact that you're the movements around the stage when you're talking to one another on the phone or to indicate distance, there are certain things that are done that to me really made a lot of sense. It kind of fit into place quite neatly, I thought.
I wish Kiff was here to talk about it.
Oh.
This is all him.
Okay.
He's amazing. Every time I watch the production, I just see the cleverness and just how intricate the costume changes are and the staging and the lighting and how he highlights certain moments that you really don't miss a beat no matter where you're sitting. And if you do miss a beat, it's intentional. It's kind of amazing that as an audience, it's almost you don't get to see everything, because some families do hide things, and especially the mother, Grace, because at first, as Wendy was saying, we kind of saw her just as pure, loving, bohemian, into her vitamins. But there is this aspect of Grace that is about the show and being a West Side mother that wants things to look a certain way.
Yeah.
Much to the detriment of her children at times. So, yeah, there is the complexity that Kif was able to really bring to the stage by staging it in the round that way. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, and the fact that it's in the round, the emotions just kind of wash over you. I mean, you're very present with this family. I almost felt a bit of a voyeur, mm-hmm. you know. I was sort of, I'm sorry that I'm invading your living room or your living space, but I kind of felt like we were just sort of right there. Like, yes. Wouldn't it be great if, like, for any family that, you know, there could be sort of a, you know, an objective observer and all these sort of unforeseen moments, and then, that might be too invasive, I guess, but, you know.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that might be a little too much.
I'm not signing up for that.
It would probably be a little too much, but it's sort of like, oh, yes, we see sort of, we can see it there, what's happening, but the family members don't. They're just living their lives. So it felt very natural in the context of the round, the round.
Everyone is a fly on the wall watching this family dynamic, yes. Watching everything happen.
And you know, we can feel a little bit smug because I didn't make that mistake as a mother, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm just kidding.
Right.
I mean, you know, I'm so much better than that.
That's exactly right. That's a line in the play.
Yeah. I had so many fascinating thoughts about the timeline and the time and place and the generational. I was thinking about the 1970s, the kinds of parenting that went on in the 1980s, and I feel like you really kind of very subtly kind of layered in the ways in which people who may have had children in the late 70s to the early 80s around that time would have had their children in a very different way from what they themselves experienced, and it was, you know, maybe they had been neglected in some way, they felt, and I just, it was a very powerful evocation of a world that I knew. What did you think about the ways that people parented, let's say, the way that maybe Rob and Grace were parented, or the way in which they're kind of reacting to?
I don't know if I should say this, but I just sort of drew on my own experiences of parenting and the people around me, and I didn't really think, you know, 70s, 80s.
Right, yeah. I mean, the effect was there, but for sure, but yeah.
So I can't really... I remember saying to my daughter when she was applying to college, you know, and I said, I wish my mother would have been interested in reading my college application.
Oh my God.
She gave me $10 and told me I could only apply to University of California, and I'm going around with you all over the country to look at schools. And I let me read this over.
Uh-huh.
You know, I wish my mother cared enough to read over uh-huh. my college application. You know, I think that's sort of it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I think maybe I'm turning red because I'm thinking, oh my God. I mean, there isn't any way. I mean, I suppose the richness of this play and the universality of it is that, you know, I can look at it and think about it and watch it and think, well, I can draw upon things that I experienced myself, you know, but other people who grew up in different times and places can, you know, recognize the same thing. So someone who grew up in the 50s in Ohio, or, you know, grew up here in the 90s or whatever, they would have different feelings about it. But we all sort of, there are so many ways in which we might identify with Grace, or we might identify with Emily, mm-hmm. who just wants to be seen. And why can't her father, who does love her, why can't he get beyond his own need to, you know, use her as a confidant or something? Mm-hmm. There's so much that was very rich. I went home and I kind of spoke about this play with my daughter. She was going to come with me initially to see it, and she's 16 now, and she comes with me to, she's come with me to many times to Antillas to see a lot of plays, and she just wasn't able to make it, but she was very interested in, she's very interested in being a psychologist one day. I don't know whether she actually will when the time comes, but she said, you know, wow, it just seems to me like there's, like psychologists should come see this show. There's something there about what makes a family work or not work, and but just in the most real, authentic way in which it's it shows up on stage. So
I think anyone with a family would connect to it. Anyone. I
mean, yeah.
I feel so connected with the Emily Beckett relationship just because my brother and I are so close. We're 4 years different, but just the love between us.
Right.
Yeah,
is
didn't you
there.
Just, you were so taken at the beginning by the scene where she sings to her brother.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and he says, just keep singing him. And just,
yeah.
I mean, only the close love between two people can represent that. It's, I just love this play so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful play, and I have to. There was something about Beckett, I think, in the hands of a less masterful playwright, a less capable actor, we might have Beckett could become. I don't know. It could be very frustrating. It is frustrating to see him not, you know, not do as well as one would have hoped, but. You find yourself rooting for all these people, right? You find yourself really rooting for Beckett to make it and to do well, so that's quite a fascinating idea. There were a lot of feelings that came up for me in seeing this play about unspoken and spoken expectations within a family between parents and children. Anyone want to? Toss that, you know.
Oh, you should have my kids in.
You have a call in. You have a call in from your kids. They can speak to that.
Yes, are you calling in?
Hey, Mom, I had an idea about that one.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, because I took some of the stuff, you know, that I've always been accused of, and I used that too. And, you know.
Was that healing for you? Was that sort of. That must be like you take sort of memories you have and write it out, and then you see. You know,
yeah, but then I just have to make sure that I don't piss anybody off.
Because that's the trick.
The first reading, everybody came in my family, and they were all like, you need to change the names. And I'm not like that. The other night at dinner, my daughter says, to her brother, you ought to go see the play. I'm not in this one. And I'm so glad. And I thought, she thinks she's not.
Wow. I mean, this idea of expectations that are, both spoken and unspoken seem to be a theme.
They just know. They can see it on your face. They know your daughters know your Achilles heel. They know your hot buttons. They just know, you know. And a lot of times when you're saying things like. I know the only thing that I can think that I can compare it to is kind of like sometimes mothers get into things with daughters about their weight, and then they say then something happens and there's an eating disorder, there's something, and you know they go to the therapist and they say, I don't say anything about her weight. And they say, I can see it on your face. I can see it on your face where you look at my plate at dinner and all that kind of thing. You know, so that's, I think parents and children, you know, and children and their parents, I mean, even with my mother now, she's 92 years old, and we still have that, you know, those unspoken kind of things that I know what's going on and I know what she's saying. I mean, I'm sure you guys all do,
too. Oh, gosh. I mean, it's not good enough that what you say, now you have to worry about how subconsciously you're appearing to your children at every moment. Oh, my gosh, it's crazy-making.
Expectations are a very, very dangerous thing in this family, in this play, and in all of our families, as is... For my mind, the illusion that we have control over any of this.
Right. It's quite an illusion.
You think that you can control what's going to happen next? Really? Good luck with that. It's not. It's not possible. I think the family in this play grapples with it. I know my family grapples with it. I know I personally grapple with it. how do I maintain some kind of control in all the insanity around?
Yeah.
Kind of have to let go of all of that and say, no, I've got nothing to do with that. I can't. Not my stuff, you know?
And I wonder why that's so hard generally. I mean, maybe not to turn this into a group therapy session, yeah. but why is that so hard generally as someone in whether we're talking about a romantic relationship or more specifically here, a parent-child relationship, why is that letting go so difficult? I mean, particularly vexing and difficult.
From my mind, it's a really existential crisis because we really need to find meaning for ourselves. We need to feel that we matter. You look up at the sky, you can't in Los Angeles because there are too many lights on the ground, but you look up in the sky and see the stars, and you realize that you're not the first one who felt love, happiness, grief, pain, despair. In the history of the world, really, your problems are that big?
Huh?
They don't amount to that much if you look at all the people and all the stars up there and how many people have looked and wished upon one.
Right.
So we feel like we have to matter in some way. And if we can't matter for our children and we can't have an effect on our children, then what's it all for? So it gets to be pretty deep.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to do what? You have to hold on to the things you love as tightly as you can, but also when they're your children, you have to teach them how to fly because they're going to leave that nest.
Yeah.
And if you never taught them how to do it because you were always, you know, you can't give them a helicopter. They got to get out there and do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Help them to fly.
Yeah. Which I don't know if any of you saw this. It was a bit of the news feed today about vaccinations and just that. Mm-hmm. You saw that piece.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking. Looking at Facebook or so. It popped up on a news feed, but that a study came out or something just today or something that parents have been vaccinating their children much, much less, not because of any fear of autism. Not that I personally don't, you know, feel there's a connection, and so, but because parents have been very averse to having their kids experience that discomfort of the shot.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
so
my
that's
God.
Yeah. So that's you know, and just the not wanting their child to experience that. Now, those of us who, you know, who've had babies and we know it's really tough when your 2-year-old child is like lying there screaming in pain and you've got to kind of hold them down so that but you have to do it. And I'm thinking that's sort of the weirdly perfect news item to pop up on my screen before I interview the producer, writer, and actor from this play, because that speaks to some kind of theme that we're talking about here. No pain. That's all.
No pain. Care, but no pain.
Yeah.
I don't think the things go together.
Yeah, yeah. This over identification, which is hard because you're right. There are legacy, and there's that speaks to the universal themes here as well.
You know, sorry to just do this
as a side note,
but I have a friend who's a phenomenal chef, and I was at his house a year and a half ago for dinner. He lives up in Portland, and he showed me some basil that he grew out in the yard that we were putting on the pizza. And it was the most amazing smelling basil I'd ever had. And he said, put it in your mouth. And I tasted it. And it was like a fine wine. There were so many flavors, so many hints of complexity to it. And I said, what did you do? How did you do this? How do you grow this way? And he said, it's easy. It's plant stress. I said, beg your pardon, what's plant stress? And he said, well, if you give the plant the same water at the same time and the same nutrients in the soil at the same time, the same sunlight, the same wind, if you don't alter things, it gets lazy. Now, what happens is, if you change those things, and I, of course, was fascinated by this, how do you change the wind? And he just laughed at me and said, the wind takes care of itself.
Uh-huh.
but you change the way that you give it nutrients, and you change the time. It starts developing what are called natural oils, where all of a sudden these are pesticides for the plant. You know, they protect themselves. They get strong. The plant gets stronger because it gets stressed.
Oh.
And as a result, the most flavorful basil you'll ever put in your mouth or under your nose is in front of me. And I made the jump in my head to, okay, so I need to chill out the next time I get stressed out. I need to realize that what does not kill us makes us stronger.
Right.
And if
right.
we can do that for our children, we're going to have some really strong kids, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
Sorry
yeah.
for the digression. But
no, what a beautiful...
We should have called it Plant Stress.
Plant Stress
right,
is the
plant
new
stress.
Name of the play. I'm really
yeah.
sorry. They'll never sell a ticket.
But that's beautiful, though, because we see that how these... I mean, it's a tragic... If tragedy results and the kids don't grow up in ways that are healthy for them, then it can be really tragic what parents with these great intentions to just want to keep and hold and and protect, right. Because that instinct that Rob and Grace have, it's so primal. Mm-hmm. We just want to, you know, not let anything happen to our children. And that instinct is so clear and I think even very, very appropriate at a certain point, you know, when they're just born and so forth. It's this primal urge that it never really dies. Right. So, yeah, you've evoked that and brought it out beautifully. So this play is at the Sacred Fools Black Box Theater. We will make sure that we put a link to the show on, you know, how people can get tickets. Quickly, is anybody, what do you have, if anything, coming up after this, after the show? That you might want us to...
Well, let's ask Rob.
Okay. Besides umpteen million commercials. I saw your reel today and yours, too. It's, well, yeah.
Looking for the next job, of course, doing that. I'm doing two plays right now. I'm working on Church and State, a play by Jason Odell Williams at the Skylight Theater. It's having its final performances this weekend. So I'm basically playing... I'm cheating on Church and State and doing Please Don't Ask About Beckett. So I'm doing five performances this coming weekend, have for the last two weekends.
Oh, wow.
It's
wow.
quite fun. I love both plays. Both have issues in them that matter a great deal to me. So yeah. I'm thrilled.
And that's it'll fantastic.
I'll be fully focused on Please Don't Ask About Beckett the following weekend.
Uh-huh.
That's going to get me through September after that. I don't know. What about the two of you?
Gosh. Going back to school this week, my children.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to go back to motherhood this week.
I'll have
the producing hat during the day. I just finished a movie called Dance Baby Dance as an actress. So hopefully that will see the light of day. I just did an episode of the TV show Scorpion, so that'll be out in a few months.
Oh.
So I just living day by day. My husband's doing his movies and shows.
So you're married to Dean Devlin, and
yes.
he's producing a show on TNT.
He does the show that Rob Nagel just...
The Librarians, first season premieres, I believe, in November.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky enough to work with Dean on that first episode a few months back. So
wonderful.
Check it out in the fall. It's fun.
Yeah, wonderful. And Wendy, I can't wait to go back and read all of your other plays because I love your writing so much.
Oh, thank you.
So I'm pleased and honored that I can't say I discovered you, but I found out about it. Now I get to go back and read all your other stuff. So
great.
I look forward to anything that's coming out of yours. I'll make a point of seeing it for sure.
Okay, great.
So
thank you.
So thank you all so much. This has
thank
been
you.
A treat and a pleasure. And I best of luck to all of you with the rest of the run of the show and with everything else. And everyone out there, have yourselves a wonderful rest of the day, rest of the week, and we will see you next week with the cast from Awake and Sing at the Odyssey Theater here in Santa Monica on In Our Times.
You're listening to In Our Times with Cheryl Lubin right here on LA Talk Radio.